Classic Business with Michael Avery on FMR.
Welcome to Not the Daily News. It's a new weekly conversation with 10X Investments because, let's face it, if you follow the daily moves up and down, which we always talk about on business shows, it's really not what good investors make. Good long-term investors are in it for the long term. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Anton Esser, who joined 10X Chief Investment Officer last November after playing a key role in transforming legal and general investment management from its UK roots into a $1.3 trillion global asset manager. Anton, you clearly believe in the mission at 10X. What drew you back to South Africa and welcome on board as the partner to this new slot?
Michael, thank you very much. Great to be on your show. 20 years in the UK. I had a fantastic career there. And as you say, we did a great job there at NNG in building it into a top 10 global manager. And it was almost mission accomplished and really wanted to come home and be part of the future of this wonderful country. That's what brought me home and, you know, very excited about what we're doing here at 10X.
What do you see as the big opportunity set, having built this huge asset management firm in the UK and looking at global best practice and where we are in South Africa? What do you see as the big opportunity to build something of significance and scale here in South Africa?
Yeah, the South African market in some ways is you know, really ahead, you know, in particular what they've done with pensions and defined contribution, et cetera. But in other ways, the other areas, it's behind. And in particular, around kind of cost management and around solutions. You know, the South African market, for example, has a very low allocation to low cost building blocks, whereas you see in markets like the US, up to 50% of equity mandates are in index building blocks. And so that focus on cost, that focus on transparency, tech enabled delivery, all of that, which is what we've seen with the likes of BlackRock, et cetera, like we saw at my previous employer, that really is where I see the future of the South African market. So, you know, coming here and being the disruptor compared to where I was in the UK is really exciting. So, you know, great opportunity.
I must say, I got that sense, and I know Gareth Stobie quite well, and recently got to know Turby van Heerden and interviewing him when he stepped into the role to lead this change, that it feels very much like a startup. It's got that energy, it's got that sparkle and twinkle in its eye that the good things happening. Now, this new feature that we're going to be talking about from week to week is really just, it reinforces that ethos and philosophy, doesn't it? That your firm is not about chasing, you know, what moved up and what moved down on a daily basis. It's about talking to the long-term thematic drivers in markets, and I think one of the big issues at the moment, certainly if you look at the Bank of America Merrill Lynch fund manager survey recently, was, you know, this question about global growth. Are we going into a global recession? And we saw, I think it was around 58% of respondents to that survey believe that a global recession is likely. And that was up from 47% a month earlier. I'm sure if you took a dipstick today, it would be over 60%. And we know Reagan famously quipped that a recession is when your neighbor loses their job and a depression is when you lose yours. But when we talk about a global recession here, it's not often we have global recessions. Just to set the context here about why there's this fear that we're going to be going into the next global recession.
Well, I mean, firstly, there's a lot of talk about it. In fact, actually, you know, in some economic textbooks, you could say the U.S. is actually in a recession. Or technically, two quarters of negative GDP prints is actually a recession, but it's not really. I mean, if you look at the U.S. economy, you know, it's still, you know, very low levels of employment. Unemployment, and it's in a relatively sound state at the moment. But, you know, the question really is, where is it going? But, you know, to answer your question, a global recession obviously requires all the major economies to be, you know, synchronized in terms of a downturn in growth. And that needs to be pronounced. It needs to be pervasive and persistent. And it's a right across outputs, you know, unemployment, income and sales. So it has to be, you know, entrenched and widespread. You know, it really can't be one which is just a small number of factors in a downturn. So.
And I think that's a significant defining feature and characteristic, and hence why, if you look at the IMF numbers, I think we've only had four major global recessions since the 1970s oil shock. Now, speaking of oil, with oil prices falling, we've seen global PMIs in retreat over the last couple of weeks. What are the flags that you're watching to give us clues into whether the world is actually going into a global recession over the next 12 months?
So I think this kind of goes to your point, Michael. It's really we're not spending a huge amount of time on triggers and short term factors. I mean, there's a lot of other players out there in that space, and that's not really where we kind of see our kind of value add. We're really looking at the longer term themes, and that really sets the scene for where we are right now. I mean, and there's two major structural trends here which are shifting. Right, number one is China. China's nominal GDP is somewhere in the 0 to 5% range. Always difficult to find out exactly where it is, but it's that kind of ballpark. Whereas, 5 to 10 years ago, it was double digits. You know, China really, since the global financial crisis, has been the only real growth engine in town. Here we are at a point whereby growth is under significant amount of pressure. And you're sure a lot of that's got to do with lockdowns and COVID. But it's really more got to do with the structural dynamics there. Firstly, debt. China in 6 years created $25 trillion worth of credit in their system. They have something like 320% debt to GDP. Debt creates a major barrier to future growth, which is borrowing from the future. And then the second element is demographics. In the 70s, China had something like 2% population growth. The next 30 years, it's actually negative. 0.5%. So the two main drivers of growth, credit creation and debt, have gone from huge tailwinds to headwinds. So what's going on in China? Sure, it is absolutely compounded by lockdowns, etc., but it really is a huge structural trend which is going to impact all of our lives for the next 10 to 20 years. And the second big theme is around easy money. Connected to China, but it's actually more of a universal thing that we've seen globally in markets like the US and Europe. Mm. Where we've had years of zero or negative interest rates. We've had quantitative easing. Now, as we know, central banks are tightening to respond to inflation. And that tightening is not only in rates, it's also in actual what we call quantitative tightening, which is the reversal of quantitative easing. And I know it's for a lot of listeners, quantitative easing, quantitative tightening is relatively technical term, but it's incredibly important to the way the monetary system works. I almost compare it to like an alien spacecraft landing on Earth with a whole bunch of money in the spacecraft and buying up a whole bunch of securities and then leaving. Well, that spacecraft has kind of come back now. And it's saying, give me back my money. Yep. And that's what quantitative tightening is. It's a huge withdrawal of liquidity in the system. That plus tightening, I mean, this is the important structural themes. Ukraine, et cetera, these are catalysts. Inflation is a catalyst, but it's really these two major things which, for us is kind of what's important going forward.
And, it's so interesting because I think just yesterday, Ian Bremmer, the very well-known geopolitical commentator, tweeted that China has passed the United States in life expectancy. And that's quite a remarkable, obviously if you believe the stats out of China, but broadly speaking, I think you can with what's going on demographically in China, and that feeds into your kind of China theme there. And also around quantitative tightening and easing, that the amount of money that we've seen added to the system since the global financial crisis, the expansion of the Fed's balance sheet, the new money that was printed through COVID, I think in 1 year we had 25 or 26% new money printed in the US. Now, it's no wonder we're seeing inflation running rampant. Now, when we talk about, given those macro drivers, the various scenarios that you're modeling on whether or not there's going to be a short or a shallow or a longer and a deep sort of global recession, what sort of shape might this recession take? Because I've heard sort of wok shape used recently. So maybe a little bit longer, but a little bit shallower. What sort of weighting are you ascribing to these scenarios?
I've got to love it about this industry, don't we? We come up with all these fascinating new ways of describing things. I think that what's so fascinating now is, that we, for the first time in more than 20 years, we're seeing inflation. In my previous life, the disinflationary trends through technology, demographics, debt, just been so pervasive in the last 15 years that the only way, you know, the only way out of it was through fiscal coordinated money printing. You know, Bernanke kind of called it monetary finance fiscal policy. And that's exactly, as you say, that's exactly what COVID did. So it was really a kind of a critical point in this disinflation, inflation debate. Now, that, together with other factors, enabled what's happened. But they are now kind of marching that back. And so, you know, the base case kind of view is that, therefore, the underlying structural dynamics of debt, demographics, technology, et cetera, will ultimately play out at some point in the next 12 to 18 months, and we'll be back to the kind of disinflationary debate, and inflation is kind of that momentary period that we've had until we have the next, you know, until we go through that deep recession, big pickup in unemployment, big collapse in markets, and then, you know, you've got the Fed standing up there saying, we're going to be cutting rates, we're going to be doing QE, except that will happen again. It's just now, compared to any time since the financial crisis, the distance to that is far, because they're hiking rates, inflation's high, they cannot be reversing that now. And hence it means that the kind of the market is almost left to operate unto itself. And that's the worst thing for a central bank. That's not the way central bankers have operated in the last 15 to 20 years. And hence that's why, you know, the kind of the market movements we're seeing and will continue to see is in a way will be kind of, you know, it will combine with the kind of the economic weakness that we're having. So the next six to 12 months timing is very difficult. But the next 6 to 12 months is going to be a very difficult period, like we've seen already this year. But it's hard to see that kind of turning quickly. And that in a way will kind of compound the downturn.
For an investor trying to make sense of all of this, I mean, what sort of advice do you have for them? How does one invest during a period where the risks of recession are high, where we're dealing with the consequences of a monetary policy response through quantitative easing and now quantitative tightening, unlike which we've ever really dealt with before in the past, and where you're experiencing these demographic shifts in the world's second biggest economy? It creates a very difficult environment with which to navigate as an investor. So how should investors be approaching this?
So, I mean, there's a number of parts of the market, in particular, if you look at income generating assets compared to any time in the last, you know, well, almost the last decade, you're getting, you know, income from owning U.S. treasuries. You know, bonds are, you know, for the first time in a long time, you know, a true safe haven. They haven't been when your yields are 1% or 0. So, you know, there's definitely income, and income orientated assets are good places to be. But I think more broadly than that, and very specific to the South African market, and we wrote actually a piece on this at the beginning of this year, is that South Africa has not, you know, unlike what you saw in the US and Europe with QE, et cetera, we haven't done that, right? We haven't actually manipulated our markets, and we've allowed markets to operate in a way whereby if you look at kind of what you get in terms of bond yields, in terms of equity valuations, it's actually a relatively attractive market compared to developed markets. Actually, it's not only South Africa, there are a number of other emerging markets where that exists. But as a South African investor, you know, remaining invested, especially if your time horizon is long, the valuation argument for South African equities where PEs are at, you know, actually relatively low levels and yields are relatively high, you know, not trying to time this, not trying to trade it, keep on averaging in, and investing with a long-term horizon, you know, that's very much our ethos in terms of how you create wealth. So remaining calm, not panicking as volatility picks up is kind of the most important thing as a long-term investor.
Well, the don't panic philosophy, I love Douglas Adams. I recently turned 42. It's certainly not the answer to the universe, but I think remaining calm is certainly a great way to be approaching this particular part of the cycle. Anton, thanks. We're going to have to leave it there. Really looking forward to bringing listeners this Not the Daily News feature over the course of the next few weeks and months here on Fine Music Radio. Take care.
Yeah, thanks, Michael.
That was Anton Esser, who's a Chief Investment Officer of 10X with not the daily news, because at 10X they know that investing is not about the daily moves, but the long-term trends to get you through.
Classic Business with Michael Avery on FMR.